We'd like to welcome everyone to the work session for the North Salt Lake City Council meeting of October 3rd, 2023. We'd like to excuse Ted Knowlton, who we think will join us later. And what about Lisa?
We haven't heard from Lisa, and she did order dinner, so she'll probably be here.
Okay. Probably stuck in traffic. First item is a presentation of the I-15 draft environmental impacts statement from the Utah Department of Transportation. Katie?
Hi, I'm actually Tiffany. Tiffany Pocock from the Utah Department of Transportation, the project manager for the study, and Katie is one of my co-workers working on the study. And we appreciate interrupting your work session today and giving us the opportunity to talk to you about the newest release for the study along I-15 from Farmington to Salt Lake City. Today, I'd like to take a moment to go over the environmental process, where this milestone is in relation to that process, which is the draft EIS, opportunities for you and your constituents to comment and provide participation on the study, and then any questions or discussions you may have related to the study. UDOT's mission is to improve quality of life through transportation. And so from the very beginning, North Salt Lake in particular has been great about giving us feedback and being a part of the discussion from the very beginning, where we defined needs associated with this corridor and making sure that as we go, and as I'll get into this in some of our slides shortly, but when we go in to rebuild this asset, making sure that as we do that, it's forward thinking and thinking about not just people who use cars, but all users and an asset to the community. Along with the department looking at this corridor, I just wanted to point out the regional efforts that are happening as well. Not only are we looking at the asset of I-15, but also statewide, other corridors such as the Front Runner, BRT from Davis County into Salt Lake, and other assets to make sure that Utah keeps on moving. As I kind of alluded to, our initial look at the corridor was a needs-based associated with aging infrastructure. The corridor, some of the parts of the corridor are the original build, so they are needing some tender loving care in the form of reconstruction. So not only the pavement, utilities, structures, and then we wanted to make sure as we look at that reconstruction, how that needs to look for your community in the future. Utah is growing. And as we look at that growth, we wanted to make sure that your constituents can use I-15 and, frankly, the industry can use I-15 efficiently and move goods and services. The table on the left is the travel time experience corridor-wide. So I know we are in North Salt Lake, but this study is looking for all the way from Farmington into Salt Lake. Corridor-wide, that's around a 20-minute commute. Doing nothing, just rebuilding the asset as it is, we're looking closer to an hour travel time. And again, as we rebuild, not only taking in community context, but also making sure that safety is in the lens. On the right, you can see a heat map of travel or accident history on the right. And so some of the countermeasures we're using for that are improved shoulders for emergency access, as well as improved geometry throughout the corridor. So again, the department is looking at I-15 because of its regional significance, but also taking into context through the 17 miles, all of the interchange needs as we look throughout the corridor. When we started this study several years ago now, several of you were in participation of the what we call walking audits, making sure that the people who are designing and refining these interchanges are making sure that not only cars are safe and comfortable traveling, but also those who walk, bike, and want to access transit. So, again, ultimately, we started with what does this corridor need? And this is what we established. You'll see that it is in line with the framework of the mission of the department to improve quality of life. Those are a lot of words. I'm not going to read them to you. But again, several years ago, we did come up with this is the need for I-15 in the future. In the fall, you may remember that we did come out with a similar effort for public engagement on what we call the alternatives. Those alternatives on I-15 themselves includes two options. One, which is, surprise, it's the preferred alternative. Option A, which is 5 general purpose lanes with an express lane in each direction. We also did research a reversible lane system. With the alternatives that we presented, again, back in the fall of 22, these are some of the travel times associated with those alternatives. Again, thinking about the corridor being removed as a barrier, we did look at, this is just corridor-wide, all of the improvements that we heard from the community that were wanted, and then we implemented as the preferred alternative to make connections on or across I-15. And all of the measures on the left are kind of the toolbox that we used for those sensitivities. I'm running through this. If you guys have any questions, please let me know. These are the interchange options. I know they're all kind of stacked on top of each other, but just 17 miles wide. These are all of the alternatives that we looked at, again, back at the fall, winter, I guess, of... we did establish working groups early on, and they have been a great asset to making sure that we hear from actual members of the community from a diverse background, making sure that from the initial scoping phase into what you'll see as the preferred alternative art is a direct reflect from hearing from your community. These are some images from the alternatives phase in the fall from the open houses. I hope to show you photos very similarly to the open houses we're about to have as the level of engagement. Our open houses are from 5 to 7, which I know can typically, like, we are all, enjoying a dinner right now. That's generally a dinner time hour or trying to, access, picking, like, taking care of your family and maybe access to transportation. In the vein of trying to remove those barriers to participation, we are offering some of these components so that more people can access that opportunity. Just a little bit of metrics again from the alternatives phase. I hope to also come and show you our draft metrics after this comment period, but all of this is in a vein of showing you what we've done to date. This is a 2 to 3 year effort of, again, many of you joined us on some walking audits. It's kind of defining the study area. We looked at alternatives. We screened against those alternatives. And down at the very bottom, you can see that that bubble of draft EIS, and that's where we're at today, the level of effort that's gone into this. So we're here. We are at the draft EIS. That is online now. We released this document on Friday, the 29th, which starts the kickoff of the comment period. So that comment period starts on the 29th, 45 days, brings us to the middle of November. There are several options for constituents to engage. One of them is a virtual option starting on the 16th. It is virtual. It will be recorded and put online after the session so that anybody can access that and see that content whenever is available to them. And then we will have in-person opportunities on the 17th and 18th, where I will have all of my technical team available for those who, you know, starting on the 29th, have looked at this document, maybe have some technical questions, and are available to, you know, hear those comments, questions, and address those any questions. What's helpful for me and my team, again, are related to, you know, what does the corridor need to look like in the future? This, we are now at a preferred alternative where we've done a ton of analysis on a specific idea that we think best meets the needs for the growth and future of Utah. Give us your ideas on what you think about that idea, and that'll be the most helpful for us as a department moving forward. Oops, I think I missed. Did I skip one? This is our study team, how to get a hold of us. The website has all, and I'm happy to pull that up after my presentation to kind of show you with the content online. But, you know, phone call, emails, you know, coming to our website, there is a form on the website where you can produce comments. Our Facebook page will have posts putting content on. We'll put a caveat that if you comment on Facebook, that is not a comment going to be put in the Federal Register. That is useful content, but just, you know, full disclosure, that is not a formally submitted comment. So kind of here's the outline of where we've been. Like I said, we've gone over, you know, your help in developing the scope. We walked through some of the alternatives, and the blue is where we're at today. We welcome your feedback on the preferred alternative or the preferred solution for I-15 moving forward. Moving next, we'll move into the final EIS, which we anticipate coming out in the spring of 24. So we will take these 45 days, collect comments, have community discussions such as tonight, and in the middle of October at our public comment period, or open houses, gather those comments, address the preferred alternative based off, you know, relative or relevant comments, and then look forward to what's called a record of decision the spring of 24. I'm so used to saying the draft will come in the fall. So that's the content we had prepared for tonight. I'm happy to go to the website and kind of walk you through a how-to guide of the website should you have any comments on or questions on that. I don't have the... Yeah, thank you. Any questions before we move into the website?
I have a general question. And maybe it's premature to even bring it up, but at some point, as you're evaluating this whole process, some people are going to be happy and some people are not going to be happy. And I know that the people in the Salt Lake City area are not happy. Is that been addressed, or is it just somebody's ox is going to get gored and it's your neighborhood kind of thing? And if that's too sensitive, you can just say, we're working on it. Or something.
No, I completely respect the comment. Like, so again, contextually, we're working with 17 miles of I-15. And what I appreciate is every city and every community has a different interest and has a different interest in I-15. And that's the stuff we want to hear. And so while we can agree to disagree in several areas, there is a very robust, that's the beauty, I think, of the NEPA process, is that is a very technically robust decision-making process where data, community feedback is a very elegant blend of what's going to work best for the future. Because we are forecasting into 2050, kind of thinking about what the community is going to need for this asset in the future. So not sensitive at all to us. We are looking forward to those conversations, both in Salt Lake, North Salt Lake, Centerville, Farmington, all of those are different. And so I recognize that those are opportunities moving forward. So the website is up. That's been the same URL from the very beginning when we started scoping. Again, with that, each milestone, it looks a little different, so I do want to take the time to kind of run through what your constituents could see. Up at the very top, you know, overview, kind of a couple of paragraphs about what the study's trying to do, kind of a focus map. If you could scroll down a little bit. I mean, there's some quick links, but... thank you. Scroll down. So this is all of the information about attending an open house, location, some amenities that are there, how-to guides. I am, you know, looking to phone a friend in case I forget anything of importance. But yeah, this is generally how to kind of participate and any information you may need. Any questions, like we are available to address those. If you continue to scroll down in kind of that dark area, that is the EIS and all of the summary, or sorry, all of the chapters that we have developed as a technical team. We've broken them out because some people, you know, may be interested in some things over other things. And so each chapter kind of goes through, their labels are associated with certain aspects of the environmental process. So chapter one is needs, chapter two is the alternatives. And then we go into kind of impacts and other, you know, very technical analyses. If you want to just keep scrolling, there's, again, a lot. Like, anybody who is looking for a late night read, there is so much stuff, good stuff here that we are happy to share. And then we kind of get into, with this white kind of banner, the some of the maps that we've tried to kind of... build so that people can readily access some very technical information. So the top left, the property impact map is just a outline of our anticipated impacts. The right one is kind of, it's a little scroll bar that you can see, what does it look like today versus what we anticipate it could look like in the future. There's been lots of questions about what, you know, right-of-way is and what the impacts mean. So we tried to develop, that's the figure on the bottom left there, try to develop some definitions for people to understand what we mean by certain things. And if you continue to scroll down, this is the comment area where on the right you can click, and then there's... like physically, if you have a specific thing, like, hey, this is of interest to me. It's a geospatially available map where you can put your comments and we can know exactly where you're talking about. But if you can, no, this is perfect. This is actually, we're in the North Salt Lake area. And these little blue tabs, you can tell, these are comments we've already gotten. Like, so we released this... we released the draft on Friday, and we are gathering comments. So this is helpful to show you, you know, how specific you and your community can be on your ideas, and it can help us know exactly kind of where you're talking about.
It's available in English and Spanish.
I was going to say, I'm happy to talk about Salt Lake, but if you want to... So some, while we're scrolling, some, you know, investments that we're doing in the North Salt Lake area, one of them, as you can see on the far right, is removing a lane from the Beck Street, USA and I, you know, USA and I, Beck Street, State Street is all the kind of the same lingo, but removing a lane northbound to provide a shared use path that connects up to the existing North Salt Lake trail. And if you want to continue north, another pretty significant investment is the a service interchange here in the 215 area where people can access over to Redwood and 215, full access there, as well as getting on to State Street, which from a traffic analysis standpoint takes a lot of pressure off of 2600 South, which you guys know is a pretty heavily utilized arterial. So continuing north, the Center Street southbound off ramp is still being proposed to be removed. Again, in context of that kind of full service interchange to the south. And I think the next probably interest point is up at 2600 South. Building a SPUI, kind of cleaning up the area with bringing the 8th West under I-15 over to Wildcat, and making that, although 10-ish years ago when the department came in and, you know, built that configuration, I call it a unique DDI, which did a lot of, you know, took a lot of pressure off of 2600 South. This will continue to do so as well. There is, you know, why we tucked Wildcat under was to, again, there's a pretty big, from the data analysis that we had, there is a large number of students using, you know, 2600 South. It's technically considered a safe routes to school. And so we feel like that would be even safer, not having to deal with the with the 2600 South interchange. So if you want to go back to the website, I mean, this is the interactive tool. Like, people can see our preferred alternative, directly comment. And you want to scroll down a little bit, please. And if you have just, you know, if none of that is of interest to you and you just want to give us a comment, there's an online comment tool for us. And then, you know, we had frequently asked questions from last time. We've updated them, and this is the frequently asked questions portion. And then lastly, the process that we're following. I appreciate your help getting the word out to the community to come and, you know, have discussions with us at the open houses. If those dates do not work, that's the kind of the point of the 45-day comment period. We're happy to have to come and meet with your community and answer any questions they have.
I guess we'll have more questions when we study it, but I couldn't see on there how much impact it has on our new park that we're putting in. So that's probably one of the bigger questions in my mind, is that as you put those lanes in going north, it looks like it's going to impact some of the land on the park. And we're just now having somebody design that. So we'd hate to put something there that has to be taken out in a few years.
Are you talking about Hatch Park?
Yes. We'll go to it here so we can look at it.
I thought the last thing I saw, it wouldn't impact.
Yeah, I don't think there's much impact on the park. But.
There's very minimal impact to the
looked
hatch
like
park.
They were measuring Maple Street to take out some houses there, and I thought, well, if they're doing that, they're taking out part of Hatch Park, but maybe not.
So at Hatch, our proposed acquisition line is very similar to the right-of-way that we currently own. We will need some what's called construction easement to frankly get construction equipment in there to build I-15. But again, that will be temporary. But yeah, specifically to Hatch Park, we are working towards minimal impact.
Okay, thank you. But this is with the exchange on the south, right? Because it looked like they had to put some on it. Go to a little bit farther south. Make sure a little farther, farther. I want to see how they ended up doing this because that looked. So I thought there was going to be a northbound on-ramp here, and I don't see it now.
Yeah. A northbound on-ramp to
I-15.
State Street or?
To I-15.
There is a northbound on-ramp too. Kind of depends on where you're. So if you are traveling.
If you're on
Beck
highway.
Street and you want to go northbound on I-15. I specifically say that because if you wanted to go northbound from 215, there is a system.
That's already there. That's what we use now. But
right.
If you're coming off of Highway 89 and you want to go northbound on I-15, I don't see the exchange there.
Yeah,
that is an opportunity now. If you're coming like southbound or northbound on State Street, you would turn right or left
right there.
Onto this interchange, and then you could. Right where her mouse is, that is the northbound on-ramp.
Now what you're looking at. Okay.
Yeah, so from where we are right here, we'd go south to get northbound.
Right, okay. Right. I see it now. I just couldn't see it look like that. It was kind of a frontage road.
There's a lot of lines, so I understand.
Okay. That answers my question.
So from, I recognize that the bureaucracy of the federal highway system has lots of square boxes they want to check. The off-ramp at Center Street exists. It takes pressure off the 26 South off-ramp, and I know it doesn't conform, but it certainly seems illogical to spend money to tear it out. And that's from, as a taxpayer, I'll sit here and say that, don't waste the money tearing it out just to make some bureaucrat back in Washington happy.
I agree with that, as well as a major safety concern in relation to this off-ramp. In many conversations with the railroad, this is like, from what I know and what I've been conveyed to the I-15 team, this is probably one of the most safety awareness places in the whole state. As well as I also am aware that grade separating in the future at this location is of interest to both the railroad and the city. And so that access would not technically work in the future. And so building the system now where that access is taken up at 2600 South and the addition of the 215 interchange is what we're showing is our preferred.
Okay.
And just as a reminder for the council, that was one of our public comments in the earlier comment period, was that we requested that the Center Street off-ramp remain in the new plan.
I also am aware, though, that there was also a comment that being forward compatible with grade separating this area is also of concerns, which is in,
yes,
you know, direct conflict.
Absolutely. Thank you for adding that.
Any other questions?
I've got one. Late to the party. Sorry.
Welcome,
Hi, Tiffany.
Hi.
Thanks. Tiffany, thanks for your you and your team's good work on this project. Basic question. So I know that the package of improvements is, by having it go through this process, you're clearing it environmentally. But is the idea also that the package of improvements, there is a commitment to funding every component of them over the near term? I'm thinking of the Beck Street bike improvement. Is that cleared environmentally, or is that as part of this package also contemplated as something that would be funded?
So this process is to, as you mentioned, environmentally be conscious of impacts to the natural and built environment. Should any, you know, construction move forward, in the document we are transparent that this is what we think it would cost to complete the whole thing, but also trying to be aware that, you know, phasing and other components may be necessary as we move forward, because, you know, it might not be in the best interest of the state to be under construction 17 miles. Maybe it makes sense to, you know, some, I know we're talking about a different region, but in Utah County, again, we kind of phased that construction. So while, yes, it is part of the improvement package, as it gets constructed, I can't tell you what the phasing would be.
Right.
If that answers your question.
Does the document then will it get into anticipated phasing of different components like the interchange or what have you?
We haven't kind of laid out any phasing scenario, but we have estimated what the total potential construction cost could be, but have left that up to kind of some future phasing opportunities.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for your presentation and all your hard work. I have a question on Beck Street.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that is a problem is there's such heavy trucks, and it's a very dangerous route. Is there any thought of dedicating one lane to trucks only on Beck Street at all times?
You know, we have heard both North Salt Lake and Salt Lake loud and clear about the industry from the gravel refinery trucks. If you don't mind zooming out of this map, we heard that so loud and clear that there is now a new interchange at the Warm Springs area where we've been working with that industry. So you'll see all the gravel pits on the east. You guys are more aware of this than I am. All of the gravel industry gravel pits, refinery in between. There's a new interchange.
You're good. Right there. Yep.
Thank you. That interchange, it will be grade separated over the railroads to get the industry that you're talking about onto I-15 as quickly as possible. That helps all of Utah, right? Like improving strong economy, getting trucks out of your community and onto I-15 as efficiently as possible. So I hear you, and that is a direct reflect of the preferred alternative. We have heard you throughout this process.
One other thing. I know you have a list of the four categories that are of most interest to you. And this is probably a hard one for you to address, but what about the aesthetics along Beck Street? Is there anything that the EIS is going to do to address that?
So the environmental study won't address that specifically, but it is part of the process should, you know, a build alternative move forward. UDOT has an aesthetics policy, that will look at, you know, I-15 should look the same throughout this whole corridor, but then also recognizing that each community might have its own desired aesthetics. And so working on interchanges moving forward, but then, you know, hopefully making sure that drivers see I-15 while they're on I-15 looking similarly, and then exiting I-15, entering into your community, you know, it's kind of something that we will work with the cities moving forward. So I don't have a great answer for you now, but it is part of the process moving forward.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you for your hard work.
And getting the word out. Again, we'd love to continue the conversation, and thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, thank you. Next item is a presentation of the Davis County Housing Program. Chanel, welcome.
Bringing up everybody. Hi there, Chanel Flores. I am the Economic Development Director for Davis County. I have my team here with me today, Ryan Steinbiegel. He is our grant administrator. And Dakota Worth, he just started with us, 3 weeks ago?
Yeah.
He is our new housing coordinator who is going to be running this program. So I'm gonna turn the time over to Ryan, and then Dakota's gonna switch out. So we're gonna play musical chairs a little bit, but excited to let everyone here in North Salt Lake know. I know Mayor Horrocks has probably seen this presentation before at COG, but we officially announced the program yesterday, and we've had quite a bit of interest. We did a whole news thing with ABC4 yesterday. Standard picked it up, as well as Fox 13 just aired at 5, the program as well. So I'm going to turn the time over now to Ryan.
Good evening, Mayor and Council members. I want to just kind of talk about a little bit of the catalyst for this program and why a program like this is needed in Davis County. So as we all know, over the last few years, housing prices have absolutely skyrocketed. Interest rates are at a 25-year high, and we haven't seen inflation like this since basically the 1980s. And so all of that has put a real big strain, particularly on low and moderate income families. I was actually going to do that while I was talking about that. So next slide. So the median home price, just kind of give you an illustrative example of what's happening and why this is such a challenge for low to moderate income families. The median home price in Davis County is $525,000. Every year HUD looks at census data and says, okay, what's the median income for Davis County? So that's a little over $100,000. And then they set thresholds for low to moderate income families in terms of what you have to make to be able to be assisted with federal dollars. So to give you an idea for what that is on this pie graph here, so I think there's a one that comes in right here. So for a family of four, 80% AMI is $85,100, which means you have a gross monthly income of just over $7,000. So if you want no more of your gross monthly income, no more than 35% of that to go towards your mortgage payment, the maximum mortgage payment you could have is $2,482. Okay, well, $525,000 median priced home in Davis County, your monthly mortgage payment with the way interest rates are right now would be $3,493. So this is $1,000 too expensive, right? So then let's look at some more lower priced homes, right? So anywhere between $375,000 and that $500,000, there's about 200-ish homes in Davis County. Here's an example of some of them, two of which are in North Salt Lake. One's 375, the other one's just under $400,000. So even at $400,000, right, $125,000 less than the median price in Davis County, your mortgage payment's still $2,661, which puts you still at 37% of your income going towards your mortgage payment. So now what if we look at the same priced home, but we come in with $50,000? That would essentially lower the amount that you're borrowing from a lender to $350,000, which would put your mortgage payment at current interest rates at $2,329. So now you're below that threshold where you're not paying more than 35% of your income towards housing costs. And the reason that's so important is once you're at that threshold, you are substantially more likely to miss a mortgage payment or default on your mortgage if you're contributing more than 30 to 35% of your income on your mortgage payment. So now I'm gonna turn it over to Dakota to talk about what the homeownership program in Davis County looks like.
So Ryan did a good job of telling you why it's important that we have this program. I'm going to tell you what it looks like when people apply for this program. This program is largely funded from two sources, a one-time $1.6 million federal funding allocation that is eligible to be used in Layton and Clearfield. And then we have a $200,000 annual CDBG allotment that cannot be used in Layton and Clearfield. And that $200,000 is pending availability. This program is set forth to offer principal reduction loans, creating more affordable monthly payments up to $50,000 in principal reduction. That is to ensure that we keep families and homebuyers under that 35% debt-to-income ratio so that they're not so burdened by their monthly payments. The program has a 1% interest rate with no required monthly payments. You will just pay the loan back when you sell the home or refinance for an ineligible reason. That creates a revolving loan fund and allows us to further administer this program, grow it organically, offer it to additional residents or future residents in Davis County. And then there's other programs out there that can help supplement some of the affordability issues that our program can't do on its own. Some of those include Utah Housing Corporation's down payment assistance and the Rocky Mountain Home Fund that offers low interest rate loans for specific professions. And I will be the face that people deal with when they submit these applications, their lenders deal with, their realtors deal with, and I want to talk to you guys about what that process looks like. So since this is federal money, there are income qualification requirements per HUD. And like Ryan mentioned, that's 80% gross AMI, which is the area median income. For a family of four, that is $85,100 as the maximum. There are debt to income restrictions associated with our program here. So 35% of your front end debt to income ratio, which is your mortgage payment, taxes, insurance, cannot exceed 35% of your gross monthly income. We also have a 50% back end ratio for debt to income restrictions. So any other consumer debt you have on top of that, if it's over that 50% threshold, you would not qualify for this program. We also have a formula for allocating the amount of assistance that we're giving homebuyers. And how that works is, say the home buyer is at 40% on their front end ratio. The county is going to allocate the exact amount of funding necessary to bring that to 35% and award that to them to reduce their front end ratio up to 50,000. So it could be 50,000 or it could be less, but we're working to make people's home purchases more affordable in that way. And we also require a few documents when you go to submit your application, that being a fully executed REPC, real estate purchase contract, and a pre-approval letter from a reputable lender. That way we have people applying for this program that are ready to go, ready to purchase homes in Davis County, and we're actively getting them into those homes. We do have a max purchase price set at $500,000, and we have a very intuitive portal set up for people to apply. It's called Neighborly. The link here is listed in our presentation. It's also on our website. It will walk people through the necessary documents they need to provide us, allow us to alert them if anything else is needed, keep a handy task list of how we move this thing forward. And it should work pretty seamless for people. And I will turn the time back over.
Okay. So a couple things I do want to add. One, this is not just for Davis County residents. So this is really for any, it could be anybody across the state or even across the nation. We want to see them move and relocate into Davis County. Again, obviously we do want to serve Davis County residents, but that is not one of the criterias. We do see that as a way of, you know, as we're talking about businesses, as a way, as they're struggling to find employees, as a way that they could utilize this to recruit new employees. Think of manufacturing jobs, right? They definitely probably would hit some of those income restrictions and qualifications to get them into this program. Another thing I do want to mention is that this program is stackable. So while we are offering up to $50,000, we will subordinate to a soft third if they were to apply for the state's 20% down payment assistance program. So those are just a couple things I want to talk through. And then another thing is we're looking at additional affordable housing initiatives. One of the things we're looking at is becoming a home consortium. So similarly to the Community Development Block Grant, we will have to have all 15 cities sign on through an interlocal agreement to create a home program. This is offered through HUD, and it's a formula based similar again to CDBG. The annual allocation for this program would give us an additional anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million that we would be able to use to target additional affordable housing programs. Those are just a few different examples. And some of those eligible activities, one, adding more funds to this homeowner assistance program. There could be a rental. You could do subsidizing rentals. You can also do public and private partnerships with developers for new development, housing counseling. There's a ton of different things that we could do for this. And so that is one of the things that we're looking at. Another thing is when we're talking about CRAs, RDAs, there's a requirement in those to have a 10% set aside for affordable housing. Oftentimes what we've noticed is that while cities get the 10 or the RDA agencies get that 10%, they don't have anything planned on how they are going to spend those funds. And so oftentimes they are sent to Olean Walker. Unfortunately, though, we in Davis County really never get to see that money come and be spent into Davis County. And so as we're looking at, you know, RDAs and CRAs within project areas, is how can the county partner with the RDA agencies to actually look at additional affordable housing type projects that we can initiate in our county and keep that money here to support our residents. All right, that is it for us. Do you guys have any questions?
I have a practical question, or probably impractical because it's so new and I don't understand it, but the $50,000, you talked about you had $1.6 million from federal funding for just Layton and Clearfield, and then $200,000 just for counties other or cities other than Layton and Clearfield. $200,000 doesn't sound like very much when you're talking about a $50,000 loan. That means four families or whatever will be able to have help. Is that what I'm understanding?
No. So,
okay.
So with the Community Development Block Grant, we are an entitlement community, and so all of the funding from CDBG can only be spent in cities other than Layton and Clearfield. That's at $200,000. $1.6 can be spent in any of our 15 cities. Did it? My bad. No. So this is, so technically a total of 1.8 could be spent within all of our cities except for Layton and Clearfield. They can only have 1.6. Does that make sense?
So 1.8, these cities can get 1.6, these two. But it's tied to CDBG when it's limited to that 200,000?
Correct.
Okay.
Layton and Clearfield have their own CDBG programs. They're large enough to have their own, so they're excluded from the county's Community Development Block Grant Program.
Correct. And sorry if that was, you guys were probably thinking, what? Yes, no, apologies.
I just want to let you know I saw the press release today in Utah Policy, and I immediately forwarded it to my son, who's looking for a house. So thank you for thinking about our kids, because that's who's going to need these.
I did exactly the same thing with my son. Immediately, it's like, oh, there's hope out there. There's actually hope.
I have a question. I can see from the press release that this opens on October 16th. Is it just as soon as we run out of money, we're done, or is there an application window?
So yes, we are planning on releasing the funds in tranches. So for the first quarter, we are planning on releasing about $600,000. It will be on a first-come, first-served basis. So those who have like sent it out, right, the biggest thing is going to be having that fully executed REPC in order to get through the application process. But because we knew that that could be a challenge for some home buyers that who might not be ready yet, that's why we're deciding to release the funds in tranches. So this time, $600,000, next time, probably $400,000, that quarter, the next quarter, $400,000, the next quarter, $600,000, and then the following quarter, $400,000.
Chanel, so this is fantastic, wonderful program. And I'm sorry, I'm absorbing the numbers and the information. What I'm wondering is, can you comment on the magnitude of the remaining problem? So if we have a certain unmet demand of people at 80% AMI, and this helps a piece of them close the gap so that they can fund a mortgage, what is the remaining? This is great, fantastic, but you know, we're also one of a number of cities that can think about housing through other tools as well. And can you just comment how much of the how much demand does this leave us to tackle?
It's still going to be significant. So, right, this is just one thing that is, we're hoping to move the needle, but this isn't going to solve the problem. What we do think that this is going to help is that when you look at those who are probably going to be able to qualify, they're going to be higher in that income bracket, right? They're going to be closer to that 85, right? Closer on the 80% AMI to, you know, maybe 75% AMI. What we do think is going to happen is that that might, say they're in an apartment that is rent controlled. They now have the ability to move their family into a house that they own. That opens up the door for those at a lower income bracket to be able to get those people into housing. So that's kind of like what we're hoping will happen. This isn't going to solve our problem. We're still going to need to do more. But it's just one of those opportunities. And so, you know, as we did our press release and done some of our news articles, one of the things is, you know, how can we get other counties and cities and the state to, you know, continue to do more to help address this issue, as well as looking at, you know, what can developers do? We have had a few reach out to us that, you know, they said, okay, on our next development, we're going to try and make sure our housing meets that $500,000. So, I mean, I do think it's positive, and I think that's even why the state made their program be only for new builds to kind of entice more developers. The problem with Davis County is that we are very limited on land availability left, and so we didn't want to have that much restriction.
Can I just add, too, that that's part of the catalyst for wanting to become a whole consortium? Where that money is specifically for affordable housing, you're right, that 30%.
You need to come to the mic so it's recorded.
Yeah. That 30% AMI, that 50% AMI, it is grossly underserved. And we need more money for things like permanent supportive housing and subsidized housing, because you're right, this program, even though there is that trickle effect that Chanel talked about, they're still drastically underserved. And by becoming a home consortium, more of that money can go towards affordable housing projects that are targeted around permanent supportive housing, subsidized housing that help that lower income group. So,
thank you.
Go ahead. So, Chanel and I have talked a little bit, but I have a couple of questions. Chanel, do we anticipate that this would be an ongoing annual program?
Yes. So the reason why, obviously, this is going to become almost like a revolving loan fund, right? Because it is due when the home buyer actually sells the home. Obviously, that's going to take years, right, for us to continue to see that. But our whole goal is to add the annual allocation of $200,000 from CDBG. And that home consortium, if we were to become a home consortium, we would have the ability to say, all right, this year's annual allocation, we want to put only to home ownership assistance.
Yeah, I guess my question is, on the $1.6 million, Would you, is that a one-time allocation? We're not going to get that every year.
No, so that is SLUFRF remaining of ARPA dollars that the county was so gracious. You know, okay. The commission noticed this and they said, yeah. Hey, we have some additional funds. We want to make sure that we are tackling this issue.
Yes, yeah. So ongoing funding would be $200,000. And as you say, any other funds that municipalities within the county wish
Correct.
To put together.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
I guess one thing I didn't understand is it showed the 1% interest. Is that, who pays that 1% interest?
So the home buyer, when they sell the house, okay. It's very minimal when you look at it at the very end, right? I think, what did we say after?
So if you've been there 5 years, it ends up being $52,500.
Okay.
1% compounded annually.
Okay.
Okay.
Well,
thank you so much for your guys' time. Really appreciate it. If there's no other questions.
I guess I just had one as you brought up that the 52,000 thing. What if all of a sudden the market drops and all of a sudden these house values go way down and then they're forced to sell or they need to sell and now the house isn't worth that much anymore? How does that work?
I will say, I got to be careful on how I say this. We never, that's not our goal, right? That's not our intention for this program. If there comes a time where somebody is going to foreclose on a home, right? We're not going to make that person file, right? It's just going to be a wash. We will eat the cost.
All right, thank you.
Yes, thank you guys.
Let's take a quick break. We're running a little behind and reconvene in 6.3 minutes.